legit.
Welcome to Strata Stories. My name is Thomas Schreiber, and I'm the Director of Marketing here at Strata. Strata is a single EMR platform and revenue cycle management service for physical, occupational, and speech therapy practices that helps you achieve a 99.99% reimbursement rate. On today's episode, Paul Singh, the CEO of Strata, talks with Megan Donaldson, PT and the Department Chair of Rehab Sciences at Medical University of South Carolina. Megan is also the president of American Academy of Orthopedic Manual Physical Therapists. Paul and Megan talk through how to create a hiring process at your clinic, why you should build a hiring rubric, what types of questions to ask during an interview, and the importance of investing in employee growth. If you'd like to learn more about Strata and see how our EMR and RCM works, head over to stratapt.com to book a demo. Now, without further delay, here's today's episode.
Let's talk about your thoughts on hiring. What is it about hiring that you really are thinking a lot about these days? And that's genuinely an open-ended question. I'm curious where you go with it, and then we'll kind of like start digging deep as you start rolling.
So you have to appreciate where I'm at, right? So I'm a faculty member who has gone up the chain, and now I'm an administrator hiring faculty members. But remember, I was also a clinician, and I was a clinician that had managerial roles. And so between a managerial role and an administrative role, there's a lot of similarities. And hiring is one of the things that I have to do quite a bit. And that's because I think right now I'm living that world again. I lived that world when I was at Tufts and I founded that program for PT the first time they had hybrid. And you need to create a team. And you need to create a team that you aren't micromanaging because you're not seeing them in the office every single day. And I'm doing that again. But again, I'm now in South Carolina and I do both. I have residential programs that I oversee and they're very used to the day-to-day. They want to be overseen. They want touch points. And then I have hybrid faculty who don't. They really just want to get their jobs done. And so hiring is a really unique opportunity. I think it's $1 million decisions because you need to figure out your fit for your culture and your community and the people that you serve. But you really need to make sure that those individuals are able to not have to be micromanaged, that you can give them key goals that they can just work towards a bit autonomously. And I feel like that's a really important thing for you to pick up on and identify in a very short period of time, like a hiring process. I mean, I don't get months and months to figure this out. I get some snapshots. And so I really have to hone in on my skills there.
I'm going to sound like a second grader here and you can talk to me that way too. It's totally okay. But as you talk about these ideas, does what you kind of advise hiring managers or hiring people to do different based on like the size of the organization? So let's, in other words, if I'm a practice owner with three PTs versus I'm a, I don't know, large organization with 1,000 people, does your thinking or your advice start to change in terms of philosophy, questions, processes? How do you think about that based on size?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I think when it is a smaller group, I will say my hands are in most all my hires because it's for a culture fit. It's to make sure it's competency-based hiring. Like, can you do the job, ethics and values? And we're making sure that we align really well. When you hire really good people, then you train those really good people to do the work that you don't need to be involved in anymore. And in an organization where now I'm a department chair, I oversee multiple divisions. I don't ask to be in all of those hires. I trust really good people to do that work. But we need to have an approach that is similar, right? And that worked really hard to do it. I will tell you, it's not uncommon for many in the academic setting not to have good standardized hiring practices. And I'll tell you from the clinical setting, HR typically does it. And that they lack some of the real clinical questions that I think some of the managers want to know or some of your colleagues want to know. So I really feel like in the beginning, there's an opportunity to have some discussions about hiring practices and how better we can do things when we think together, like, right? So what do the individuals need to know? Mm-hmm. So yes, I would say I'm in at first and then I like to pull back out, but have a structure that works for a lot of people, enforced and encouraged by the people that it serves. So if you're going to be working with me, hopefully you feel like you had an input in who was going to be hired to work with you.
Interesting. And so a lot of the people I end up talking to on a day-to-day basis tend to be practice owners. And like I said, sometimes they're like super early and they, you know, it's maybe them plus one or something. And then other times they've grown quite a bit and they've got 10, 20, 30 locations and whatever. But I guess, and I know this is kind of like a hard question to maybe answer, but let's just maybe kind of throw it out there and see where it goes. I feel like a lot of practice owners fall into one of two camps. They either are like super optimistic and they're like, okay, let me figure out what these new grads or what these, like, I would say they're optimists and they're like realistic about what PTs and OTs that are in the industry today want and expect out of a job. And then there's this other group of practice owners that I would describe just very broadly as like pessimistic, where it's like, okay, all these people are out to work a little bit and ask me for a lot of money. And in my opinion, you can't really do much about the pessimistic people. But for the optimists, though, what should a hiring process or a screening process, what does it look like today in 2024? You're in this like unique position, I think, where we haven't talked about it yet, but you've got your own clinic, this clinic that you've got back in Ohio. But in your day-to-day work at MUSC, you're probably seeing a lot of up-and-coming PTs. Like, how do you think about hiring processes now and stuff like that? I'm dancing around this a little bit. I apologize. You know, as we get to know each other, I'm just trying to figure out like how far to push here. But what does a hiring process look like in 2024 today in terms of screening and stuff like that? And if that doesn't make sense, by the way, I'll use an example of my own as we think about hiring on our side of the business. But let me just pause there for a second and see what you think.
Yeah. So I think growth-minded people, it's a little bit easier to talk about versus the pessimistic outlooks. You know, I think we have to appreciate generational differences. Yeah, they exist, right? And so we have to appreciate some of that and diversity. I mean, people have different backgrounds. And so I always try to take those things into consideration. But the number one thing I look for are character traits. So we think those are soft skills. That's a military word because it wasn't a hard skill, being that it wasn't military-based, it wasn't guns. They were the skills that are problem-solving, critical thinking, communication, the personal effect when somebody has a conversation with you. And mm-hmm. I believe so much the research is actually looking at patient-centeredness. And I believe anyone we should hire, whether it be a clinician, frontliner, or my faculty, have to have an awareness of person-centeredness. Like, how do we think about somebody else versus ourselves? And when we look at generational differences. There is a difference in some of our times. It needs to be inherent training for some of our younger graduates to make sure that they are taking the time to learn about how to treat other people. It's not about their needs right then, right? There's a difference. Our culture has changed over time, and we really have to help coach our younger clinicians and our students to be very aware of this, things that we didn't have to talk about, we're talking about, like, what are soft skills? What are these character traits that we're talking about? How do you make a decision when it's not in your best interest, but it's in the best interest of the patient? So mm-hmm. those are things that we actually have to have those ethical conversations and give them a lot of case studies so that hopefully when they get to the clinic, they're a better product that can help make those decisions. But, you know, again, you go back to hiring as a manager, you want to make sure you're asking those questions, because the better the practitioner who's rendering good care to those patients, you're going to keep them in your house a little while longer. And retention's a big deal right now in the therapy world.
Yeah. And maybe switching on to the other side of the table here for a second on the, and I don't know if this is a fair question, so you can take a pass if you like, but in terms of like curriculum for students today, like I remember when I went to George Mason University on the engineering side 20 plus years ago, and I remember there was like barely half a semester at the end of your 4 years that talked about how to interview, and this is mid-90s or whatever. What does training look like today for students?
Yeah, so I think it's multifold. I mean, really, I don't undersee their undergraduate degrees. And so I would imagine that somewhere, you know, when you have career advancement people at the undergraduate level, knowing that some of them are going to move on to what I would say is like graduate school or go get a job. So there should be some training at that level. The other level that I would say I would imagine would be important would be when we do get to like PT or OT, you know, in grad school. And yes, we do have it. It's not a requirement. There's career training and there's job training. And we do, many of us, like, again, I can't speak on behalf of all, it's not an accreditation requirement. It's the added value of going to an institution that you have faculty who really care about the outcome and getting our students into great places. We teach them how to interview. I do a lot of behavior-based interviewing. My background and skill set's actually motivational interviewing, and they align very well because it's more about getting them to tell me a little bit more about the things that they're doing and why. And so behavior-based interviewing aligns very nicely. It's also very much evidence-based, that that's the better way to determine some of the trait and characteristics that I want to look for.
Interesting. Yeah. over the last couple months, we've been talking to a lot of practice owners, and I don't mean to stereotype them, but it seems like, I don't know, like some of them sort of look down at this newer generation and they're like, oh, look, they're on TikTok or whatever. And the pessimists of the group are like, oh, this is horrible. What a waste of time. And then the optimists are like, well, wait a second. As we move more and more towards direct access and stuff like that, maybe we can get those people in here and stuff like that. So it's, I don't know, it's just been really fascinating. All right, so let's kind of maybe go back to the practice owner side. And again, feel free to modify the questions however you like. But in the pre-show interview, there was a comment that Thomas had made, or a question that he had proposed around underrated types, that you might have some very interesting thoughts on some underrated types of questions that hiring managers should be asking during the hiring process. What are those underrated questions that you don't think hiring managers ask enough?
I ask a lot about crucial conversations. So when there's a conflict between two people, how do they work to resolve it? Because I think we don't always like conflict. Social media definitely doesn't like conflict. And you know what? We have a lot of people who like to see their post and see positive things on their post. And as soon as there's something negative, it makes it hard. It's why Twitter actually is a little bit challenging, because there can be a lot of banter back and forth, hopefully respectful, not always respectful. So I think we have a bit of a fear around Discord, right? And sometimes that can be a little bit challenging for some of these graduates coming out, how to have those crucial conversations in a respectful environment. Mm-hmm. So I ask about that. I ask about how do you avoid conflict, or how do we address conflict if it's already happened? I ask, how do you have a conversation where there's some high stakes, and how do you maintain some of your communication? What kind of things are you thoughtful about and how you communicate? And I think we forget that communication is an essential skill, and that actually takes a lot of thought. We sometimes just throw communication out. Oh, it's just a skill we do. But it's a skill, when done well, is actually a great asset, and it can be a difference maker.
Not that my opinion matters. I like the way you said that, though, because one of the things I think a lot about in a similar context, I suppose, is that the hard skills of most things that people want to do are pretty well documented on the internet now. Like, you can... And I'll make this up just so it's random. It's like the hard skill of, like, how do I do a pivot table in Excel? Well, you can Google that now. It's on YouTube. I mean, there's just a million ways, but the soft skills aren't really discussed or documented very well, even in 2024. And so this is a poorly articulated way of just maybe agreeing with you that I think that people undervalue the soft skills. Like, in a world where, whether we like it or not, patients are Googling what's wrong with their back or why their back hurts, we can argue all day about, like, whether or not you should trust a website. But at the end of the day, like, the soft skills of how you felt when you went to the office to meet a certain PT or OT or whatever, it was a long way. Like, I guess the summary is that I think the soft skills are the differentiator. And I don't think people really talk about that very often. Anyway, not that my opinion matters, but I like the way you actually put that there. All right, so now let's kind of go into your rubric. In the chat that you had with Thomas earlier, you talked about the hiring rubric. And I actually asked Thomas, I was like, hiring rubric? That was like pulling out an SAT word for me. I was like, what in the world? So let's talk about that. What does a hiring rubric sound like?
So I went a bit academic on you. Sorry about that. But I would say, So a hiring rubric is categorized in ways that align with my core values in terms of the organization that it serves. So the core values of the organization. So what matters most to you as an organization, or who do you know you work best with if you're more similarly aligned? And that way, it's about the diversity and the inclusivity of all, right? These aren't race or ethnic-based questions. It's about, how do you communicate, all right? What is your core value around collaboration? What is the core value around innovation? So you have a topic, and then underneath those topics, you have some behavior-based questions, and then you have a ranking, like a one, they didn't describe it very well. Two, they gave some decent examples, not well in depth. Three, average answer, you know, and you can have some modifiers to how you give your scores. Four or five, like five, I want this person. Like, this person is amazing in the way that they communicate. And we should do something more objective than non-objective when we look at the literature around, again, hiring practices. They're very biased, and they're very biased. Do I like you? Do you like me? Okay, let's move forward. What if we used a little bit more data-driven decision-making? You know, you summarize multiple people's opinion on some kind of standardized rubric, and it really does help you figure things out a little bit better. Anyway, that's the way we've done it. I will say that I've built teams, I've inherited teams, and I've done a mix of both. And every time I introduce this hiring rubric strategy, people like it. And all of a sudden, what I would say was very heterogeneity in terms of our outcomes of who we liked and what we liked, it started to streamline what we were looking for together. And I think that if you don't know who you're looking for as a hiring manager, you have a problem. You should know what you want to hire.
Right.
And it should align with your core values or, you know, the organization's mission, goals, values, whatever. But I don't know that we always make decisions based on that. And so, again, some of your questions should align with those areas so you can really vet out your candidates in that way.
Yeah. By the way, I appreciate you bringing up that word, though. I feel like I said, I haven't heard it in a while, but it's actually a good thing. Let me make a statement. I'm curious if you would agree or disagree with this. I think that most practice owners don't have a rubric. They probably have convinced themselves that they have, they're like, oh, I know it when I'll see it. But actually, if you force them to write it down, they may or may not have these core values. They may not, like, you know, it's an uncomfortable thing. But I think kind of going back to the beginning of the hiring process itself, they also probably, I would imagine, and this is the statement I'll let you either agree with or disagree with, is that I think they don't put enough thought into like the actual job description. Like, in other words, I can't tell you how many times I've met a practice owner that's like, oh, it's so hard to hire today. You're like, oh, it's so hard to hire today. And then, you know, you're like, oh, what's going on? And they're like, oh man, like nobody wants to work or this, that, and the other. And then you're like, okay, well, what did the job description look like? They're like, oh, I saw this job description at the local hospital, so I copy and pasted it or whatever. And I'm like, if I read that, that is not the description of the practice that I thought you ran. And that's not exciting to me. And I think the people that that's going to like attract, even though you don't have a rubric written down, it's not going to work. Would you agree with that though? Because they don't have that rubric, they just attract the wrong people. What do you think of that?
Yeah, because you have me at hello, right? I read the job description. If it doesn't map onto what I want, then I'm not interested. And I will tell you, I think we have to appreciate times are changing, period. Then use AI. If you're not creative and can't, you don't have time, AI, ChatGPT that, you know, like let's use resources to make you work smarter, not harder. And if you have some strategies that you know are essentials, you put those into ChatGPT, it can help you to create what you want. I'm actually probably on the far end. I like try to make sure that they understand all of their roles so that when we're having a conversation, I'm not telling you what I expect out of this role. If you didn't read the description, then shame on you. I put a lot of time, energy, and effort into that description. I hope it was super clear to you that we both are on the same page that this is what this job is. I'm a busy human. I don't have a lot of time to coach you through a job description if you didn't read it. That's an exodus for me, right? That's an easy out. I make it sound kind of hard, but I've been very fortunate in two areas. One, right, I work in a hybrid environment where I can gather potential candidates from all over the country, and I'm very fortunate for that. I've also been in residential, in which my candidate pool is very slim. I've also been in the clinical life where you get people who either job jump or they're just looking for the bonus and the salary raise or whatnot. I mean, you tend to know your industry, whatever areas that you're practicing. So from that end, I tend to ask some of the people, what does this job really do? Like, what do you feel are essentials for this role? And I think we try to capture that. And so, you know, when I think about clinicians, I think about the same thing. If a hiring manager isn't getting the outcome that they want, then they either need to cultivate the environment or recruit specifically just a little differently, or connect with the local institutions, help them build who you're looking to hire. I mean, collaborations are a critical opportunity between the clinical practice and the academic settings. Do you know how many times I have to do interviews and practice interviews and admissions? I mean, if we had clinicians who wanted to help support that, then help the institution that's going to help feed you as a clinician. Right. I think there's ways to work better together. And I still think we have good silos around academia and clinical life. You know, I oversee the pro bono clinic in therapy, but that is a very small entity. It's less because it's really all I can do is in the summertime work with that group. And it's just three colleagues and I work together. We have a chat, we communicate. It used to be me and then it became two and now it became three, which works out really well for us. But I don't have to hire people in that house.
Yeah,
I do understand what that house is. And communication is the biggest thing. And grooming people to help grow things is one of my best advices in terms of getting those good quality people.
Have you ever stumbled across any good resources online? Like, so when, let's just say somebody listening to this now is like sort of nodding in agreement and that self-reflection, they're like, oh, you know, this makes sense. I should have done this. Are there good resources that you've seen in your experience that they should Google or subscribe to that maybe gives them a good idea of what a starter rubric might look like, what a good starter, you know, does that make sense? Yeah. Like, are there good resources out there right now?
Well, you know, you and I are connected on LinkedIn, and I'm going to say LinkedIn is the most probably underestimated power resource for tools and tips and connections with people. It's non-threatening. They share things very freely on there. I get all kinds of tips and strategies and organizational management that I love. I don't have to read another book. I read a lot of books, but like Good to Great is one of the first things that kicked off that my mindset was like, yeah, I'm good. I want to be better than good. And so how do I challenge myself? And, you know, getting uncomfortable, just think about that. We don't like to get uncomfortable, but getting uncomfortable by asking questions of somebody that maybe knows differently, knows better. Maybe you ask your HR or an HR person who, hey, LinkedIn, connect with them. I mean, I'm sure they have tools and strategies. So a single clinician doesn't have to be the master of all. They certainly have to have an understanding of their industry, but an awareness, right? The emotional and social awareness that they may not know everything and they can connect with other people who have those tools. So I don't have a single tool. I have a connection ability. And if I see that I don't have it, I ask.
Yep. Whenever you talk to experts about what they're good at, it's always fascinating to kind of like watch how their brain works. So let me ask you, let me just kind of set up a hypothetical scenario. I heard your story. I heard this episode, whatever. And now I'm going to like find you on LinkedIn or I'm going to cold email you. And I'm going to say, Megan, gosh, I'm having such a hard time hiring people. I've got this practice or this business, you know, whatever in Oklahoma. Can you help? Given your breadth of experience and all that stuff, how do you poke? How would you start to find the red flags? Because you have the same 24 hours in the day as everybody else. You probably can't help every single person. But I suspect there's some like heuristics or algorithm you have in your head, even though you don't call them that, where you're able to like quickly suss out what the red flags are and figure out what mistakes I'm making. What does that look like for you? So I'm now like coming to you for the answer, you know, and you're poking back. So what does that sort of look like in your head? How do you poke out or find those red flags that I've committed without knowing, I suppose?
Yeah. Well, if you ask me about money right away, red flag. If you ask me what the salary is before you've asked me about anything about the job, red flag. And that happens more than I want to tell you, right? So, or if they want to ask about their growth opportunity rather than just asking about the opportunity, that also tells me you're not really interested in this opportunity, you're interested in the latter. And that's also not something I'm interested in dealing with. Yeah. If somebody is very, I always say the word authentic, and you can sense it just in the communications, and words matter, words on paper matter. If they're authentic and they're asking with curiosity, hey, I've done this and this and this. Tell me what you did. Tell me you've done something. And then I'm happy to provide some additional guidance and resources. I mean, or tips and connections or people like that may know better than I do, right? So that's what I would look at. I mean, again, I think it's all about in the words that you communicate. And then if you have done the work yourself, then it gives me a little bit to know that you're willing to put some work in. Yeah. My time is important to me, but I also am a bit of a servant leader, but I'm a situational leader. I read the room.
Yeah. There's a reason why I'm not in academia, I would say, other than my patience. It's also the fact that I probably talk like a second grader. And I was talking to, when I end up talking to like, you know, I would say like people earlier in their career or whatever. And they, again, I don't have the breadth of experience that you do, but I was just telling them like, look, man, the goal of that first meeting, whatever you're going to do is just don't be weird. Don't be weird. You just sort of got to figure out how to line up your words and your energy with whatever that job description was. If that job description was like super crisp and clear and, you know, all about the job, not the opportunity, then just don't be weird and focus on just talking about that. And on the flip side, if the role seems really ambitious and they're talking about growth opportunities, well, then great. You got to match the energy. But that's about all I can tell you is just don't be weird. Anyway, that's why I'm not in academia.
But. No, I go to conferences all the time and I meet a lot of people. And I will say, you can read the individual, whether or not they have just that authentic curiosity, epistemic curiosity, where they're just super curious and authentic. And I love that.
Yeah.
Or if they're coming with an agenda. And I usually can determine that too. So again, I always think about what's in it for you and what's in it for me. I enjoy helping people. Obviously, it's the reason I got into both PT and education. But at the end of the day, it can also be abuse, right? Like when you're just leaning in all the time.
This is maybe personal here, but if we were to time travel back to you in your earlier career, were you always this way? Like, were you always thinking about, I don't mean that as a weird question. I'm just curious, like what made you get so excited about this side of things? I mean, was it like a personal experience or a bad employment? What was it? Were you always this way?
No, I don't know that I was always this way. I was in leadership a lot. I mean, if you go way back in my journey, I mean, whether it was captain of a team or vice president of my class and then student government president at all, whatever, I was always in leadership and I loved that. But when I got, I think, into some of my first positions, there was definitely some concerns and bias that I recognized. One, I was a female. Two, when I wanted to have a family, I didn't fit the mold anymore. Mm-hmm. And then again, when I got into faculty life, I was young. And then I looked to go into as a leader. And I actually had one person tell me, you shouldn't go into leadership. You're a mother. And wow. I think I use that as passion because I think you can do a lot of great things with people and you can encourage them and you can help grow them. That's the number one job I have as a leader. But it's also important for you to decide who you're going to hire. Because if you have to micromanage them and you can't help them grow, that's a you problem, not a me problem.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So it's a hiring practice.
Yeah.
And culture, really.
I appreciate you sharing that too, because I think that there's not a lot of discussion about that, that what you just described there, like those biases and stuff like that. And I think that it's real. And unfortunately,
it happens.
But you know, it's one of those things where it's like, unless we talk about it, it doesn't actually get any better. Again, I really appreciate you opening up like that. That's really, really interesting. And I hope that at the very least, other people listening to this kind of take away that they're not alone when they experience those things. So I'm not sure if you'll be okay with unpacking this. You said you started to like channel that passion, right? You mm-hmm. used it as passion. I think that was the exact phrase you used. You've mentioned books on this conversation. So you mentioned Good to Great. But when you talk about like starting to use that passion like that, you know, when you started to feel those roadblocks and stuff like that, were there other resources that you went after? So it was Good to Great. Were there other books or resources that you wish you'd found sooner when you think about this?
Yeah. So you guys, I mean, your listeners probably are familiar, but Brené Brown has some great podcasts and she has, especially for female leadership, I would say that's great. The other books that I think about, John Maxwell, I mean, he's got some great leadership books. Simon Sinek, Starts with Why, because you can't really start anything unless you understand yourself. And then Adam Grant, Think Again, I think is this super innovative book. His Hidden Potential right now is like one of my favorite reads. I'm like, I think I'm going to read it 5 times. It's a fast read. It's not hard, but it taps into everything. And it literally reminds you of like when you were a kid, why you did things the way you did. And then you analyze it and you think about it and you're like, oh, this makes sense. And if you're kind of a perfectionist, that gets in the way of progress. So get rid of that and move forward. And that's so hard to tell your younger self that. So now that you can just be in a different phase of life and evaluate where you are and the decisions you get to make going forward, you're going to be the same person you are today 5 years from now, but the books you read and the people you meet. And you know what? It's so true. You read a lot, you meet a lot of great people, they advise and mentor. And I'm very fortunate to have had that, but I wouldn't have done that had it been very comfortable and not working out of my comfort zone. And so I'm actually grateful for all of those challenges. Somebody telling me I couldn't be a leader because I was a mother. Somebody telling me I couldn't work full time because I was going to have a baby. There was no way I could keep working. And yet I ended up working on my PhD. I went part-time home healthcare. I started teaching and my life went way up. So thank you for all of those challenges that made me better.
That's great. So a couple of weeks ago, there was this CSM conference and I didn't attend, but I've spoken to a couple of folks that did. And I said, well, what was it like? And a couple of people that have been going there for years were like, well, just imagine it's 10% people that own practices or whatever. And then it's like 20,000 up and coming students that are just trying to figure out how to get their first job. So like, let's just imagine that some of those people were here, maybe undergrad's not the right word, but let's just assume that like there's a bunch of PTs and OTs or whatever, just out here right now. They're like, Megan, how in the world am I going to find my first job? What do you tell them? I feel like the advice I would have gotten from my mom 20 years ago, and again, I'm not a PT, but it was just like, just get your foot in the door somewhere. Is that still the advice that PTs earlier in their career should get these days? Like, what's your personal advice to them?
I believe in value add from the institution. So what I say is I'm happy to write letters of recommendation to people and use my network to connect my students. And I've done that very successfully. Because it's kind of a foot in the door. You know somebody and you know they're good people. You connect good people with good people. That's part of our networking ability. So that's something I try to do. And I encourage my faculty to do the same thing. So, and I know MUSC, they do it. I know at Tufts, they used to do it. If you go all the way back to my Walsh days, they used to do it there too. And so whether it was local or further away, I'd reach out to people like, who do you know in this area? Who's a good hire in this area? So certainly networks and connections. I appreciate CSM. I do. 15,000 people embarking in one city is no joke. But when you look at the reason for that is students no longer have an option. They got rid of student conclave. And so they really funneled them all to this conference. And when you look at the exhibit hall, it is the most overwhelming for somebody who's that's very socially anxiety filling. This whole huge exhibitor room that people are just everywhere. I don't know that that's the best way to meet somebody. It's certainly a first foot in the door if you're looking to relocate, right. But communication, I think, is one. Who do you know? You know, maybe a pre-screen, yeah. If you can find that out. I've heard bad stories otherwise. And so don't let your friends work for bad people. I mean, if they're your colleagues or your former students, help them out. Yeah. And that's an important thing. Like, I have no problem reaching out. I'm president of AOMP. So the answer is if they're in orthopedics, I'm going to find out who they want to work with and see if I can help them out. Right. I mean, use my connections. Yeah. I'm fine with that. I don't mind. And right. My people don't mind. People who get it, what we're doing, we want to have the best students in the best clinics because that's a great opportunity. So the only other thing, Paul, I'd say is hopefully their clinical instructor is also very mindful about that and is building relationships in the community so that those clinical sites want to take our students and maybe potentially screen them for a potential job in the future. It still happens, especially in a deficit right now where the clinics are still struggling to keep students turning into clinicians.
Now that you say that, earlier in this conversation, you talked about the hiring rubric and you talked about like what that looks like and all that. Should PTs looking to get employed have something like that as well? I guess let me just be really direct. I think if I was sitting one-on-one with any individual and I said, would you work with an organization that doesn't agree with your core values? They would say, absolutely not. I would never do such a thing. But then you look at sort of what anecdotally on the whole, students or younger people in their career, I shouldn't say younger, but people earlier in their career, when you look at them as a group, they kind of don't behave that way. It's kind of like, let me just take any job I can, or let me just kind of, I don't know. So should there be a employment rubric as well that PT should be thinking about before they set out to go to like a CSM or something like that? You're already nodding, so I'll just stop there.
So Paul, I think you said early red flags. Well, I say there's certainly some red flags that I coach my students to pay attention to. Okay. And those core value pieces are still there. And I always look at an interview as a match. I dated a lot of people before I got married. So, obviously it took me a long time to figure that out. But I would say that's kind of what this is. And people need to date a little bit. They need to try the work environment. If they didn't work before school, they may need to understand just employment life. And they may find things out that they didn't know that they needed to ask questions. We certainly give them some ideas of things to look out for, right? Some of those end up being about, mostly, the financial side of things and or benefit packages and negotiation and those kind of things. So we help them do those things. But growth and development and an environment in which they can feel that they are empowered to be their best selves, their best clinician, those are absolutely critical. I mean, if somebody's pushing somebody to a point where they can't even think because they're required to see so many patients, especially as a new grad, that is not a win for a new grad. They need time to learn and grow, and the culture should empower them to do that. Those are some red flags. Now, it's not to say that fast-paced clinics don't work. It just may not be the best setting for a new grad who may need more time to hone in on their skills. Right. And so, certainly we have those conversations, but there are some red flags. And I've certainly heard some bad stories, but I've heard some really fantastic stories too. And so this day, I don't know that there's a cookbook for that, but there's definitely this, go back to your why. What are you looking to do? And what is it that you want out of this profession? And align it the best you can by determining if that's a good fit for you or not. It doesn't have to be the marriage. It doesn't have to be the one that you settle down with for the rest of your life, but it does need to be the opportunity that at least fits your bucket. I moved a lot. I went from job. Yep. I was always at a job for definitely more than a year. Yep. And most of mine, it's 4 and 5 years before a transition. And then a long time relationship when I was at a clinic in Ohio, 20 years with that group. And so you start thinking, I went to different clinics. I had different managers, but I learned a lot from all of them. And so it wasn't what they did to me. It was how I learned from them. And that started on. But you're never going to find the first and best. Yeah. It's going to be maybe a few dates and then you'll figure some things out. But there are some red flags they have to be aware of.
Yeah. It's just interesting listening to you talk about it too, because it's so, I feel like I might offend some people when I say this, but the more I learn about this PT industry, the more I'm convinced that it's pretty much like every other industry, in the sense that a lot of the ways you think about hiring or career development or just the business model is so similar. And certainly there's like some differences that are specific to this industry. But, you know, I think the challenging thing I've said to a couple folks as I've learned about this is I'm like, look, 80% of every industry is pretty much the same. You know, like how you hire, how you fire, how you do your accounting, how you do payroll, it's all the same. It's that last 20% that's different that really matters here. Coming back to like practice owners now. So they've got this like rubric, hopefully they're listening to, maybe they're reading some of these books that you mentioned as well. Are there any other like pieces of advice you would give them? Like I'm just a really visual thinker. So when I think about it, it's like, if you were just sitting there with one or two practice owners, just on a one-on-one basis, the cameras are off, nobody else is listening, and you just had to be direct with them and say, hey, look, if you don't want to screw up this hiring, here's what you need to do. Is there anything else other than like what you've talked about so far? Like you've talked about rubric and the red flags and all that, but is there anything else that you would say to them if the gloves were off and you had to be real direct and you're like, man, I got to be in another meeting in 10 minutes, so I'm just going to say this to you directly?
Yeah, I would say hopefully the interview process is a reflection of the group who's hiring, right? And most of what we've talked about thus far works really well in an outpatient environment. And again, that's really the industry you're describing, right? The one that, you know, they're business owners and that's kind of the environment. Hospital-based acute care and the neuro facilities that are long-term care facilities just run differently. Yep. And so it's hard to say that's extended to them, although I would still argue professional growth is still a motivating factor for many. Fair pay and compensation and looking at their benefits packages, that transcends whatever environment you're looking at. But at the end of the day, what I would say is you need to make sure that you have hired somebody that you are invested in their growth and their learning. Because what we're finding out about this generation is they are focused on the greater why, on the bigger serve. It's not just about themselves. They really aren't about that. They're about an institution that's doing something. They're about an organization that's doing something bigger, being part of something bigger. And so if you're not in it for them to help them get there, then you're right. They're probably not going to pick you. Mm-hmm. And it makes it hard for some of these smaller practices to thrive that way. But that's when I think about collaboration with the academic institution. Like, how can you join that academic institution and make it a bigger impact? How can you serve the population? I know a couple practice clinics that has a 5K. She runs a 5K for the community because she just wants to be a way that people know her and build in this wellness side to knowing her as the right clinician. And she is a community leader. She's on a couple different boards. So she's invested in that, she's growing some of the clinicians. Now, she may not be able to pay those clinicians as much, but she is a mentor beyond mentor, growing them in a private practice. And then maybe eventually making them, you know, a small partner in the practice. That has happened very successfully. So yeah, if it's about you, the answer is, yeah, students are going to figure it out.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Strata Stories. Strata is a single EMR platform and revenue cycle management service for physical, occupational, and speech therapy practices. Helps you achieve a 99.99% reimbursement rate. If you'd like to learn more about Strata and see how our EMR and RCM works, head over to stratapt.com to book a demo.